Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
Well, obviously I failed in trying to get through both Virginia and the New York ratification debates, but that last testimony in the previous episode summarizing the Virginia ratification debates, as we closed that out, because we're done, the important parts were those things that I highlighted, the limitation on religion, the fact that our guns cannot be taken, that the Constitution did not meddle with that. And then, as I pointed out, the Bill of Rights even secured these even further to keep the federal government or the national general government out of these issues that they have no business being involved in. We had a general government created for external purposes to protect us from external enemies as well as domestic, with the association only via the militia, so that the general government could then call up the militia in dealing with invasions as well as internal rebellion. Let's say, just like the Civil War, or there's an uprising like Antifa wanting communism, socialism now. The role of the general government is to go and suppress that. Those people should be tried for rebellion against the Constitution. They should lose their citizenship or the ability to vote, as well as banned from ever being able to be a public servant in any capacity. And yet today, we actually have people that have supported direct rebellion against our Constitution, and they are now serving in public office, such as Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton marched and protested against the U.S. government. But if you start looking at the fact that there is this communist flair to this, anybody that is supporting the concept of open borders is not supporting the Constitution. It is not a matter of, you know, opinion or the right of expression. If you are a public servant, you should be stating we need to support the rule of law and the Constitution, not decrying open borders and then going down and supporting these people walking across the border or giving them aid and comfort. That in itself is a clear violation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Friends, there's no doubt in my mind, a long, long time ago, the good Lord knew exactly what we needed. And he, through inspiration, basically ordained that in this Constitution, we would have the tools necessary to be able to reclaim our republic, hence the name, Reclaiming the Republic. Now, as you know, you're listening to the only show that gives you these academic nuggets, the academic evidence that proves the argument that we're living under. We're living under this huge blanket of federal tyranny and nobody's recognizing it. And you hear people talk about ideologically waking up, you know, the Democrats against Republicans. Wake up, folks. How about waking up to the Constitution and recognizing that there is collusion within the Republican body, that we can call them rhinos, or you can call them operatives. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking and considering writing an article just regarding, I don't think the term rhino really describes what these people are doing that call themselves Republicans but do not support the Constitution. They are far more subversive than just the concept of a rhino. These are operatives who are deliberately participating and acting in a play of deceit in getting people to believe that they hold these truths to be self-evident. And instead, they're doing everything they can to wipe away our inalienable rights. Now, many of these people may not even know it, but the agenda that they are supporting is leading us specifically down that path of losing our liberties. And as a matter of fact, if you don't know, I mean, this is going on everywhere. You see these things, and I'm finishing up an article regarding this hit job, this takedown, and this is happening everywhere where they're going after constitutionalists and conservatives. If you don't start waking up, it's going to be happening more and more. It's almost like the gold star that happened in Germany with the Jews. Conservatives are being branded, they're being marked, and they're being hunted in a fashion of McCarthyism that is not based on the Constitution, but is based on an ideological perversion of our government. Anyway, as you know, the show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. Now we're going to move on to the New York debates. Now, one of the things that I probably want to, kind of tell you, and let's get into the ratification of the Constitution. June 25th is when Virginia sealed the deal. Now, at that point in time, New York had already convened its convention. And as a matter of fact, let me pull up the convention. And the opening statements were June 21st. In other words, they actually started convening 4 days before Virginia actually had voted to ratify. They waited and waited, and Hamilton stalled and stalled, and it went a whole month before they finally got the word, and the sentiments were forcing the change when they finally voted and it was a done deal. Now, I'm going to tell you that even though Hamilton was being nefarious with machinations or these designs of not honoring the Constitution, the fact of the matter is, nowhere in the New York ratification debates will you find any evidence that is contrary to what all the other evidence and the terms and definitions that have been provided via all of these other state ratification debates. There's no evidence that refutes those things. In other words, it's one thing to say, well, this is really up to interpretation because, there is this theory of implied power. But that was not presented until after the ratification debates. That is when these men, waited for a little bit of time for people to, not necessarily have. They didn't have YouTube. They couldn't just make people eat their own words by playing recordings of what you said earlier. And these ratification debates were just literally annals. They were just records of history that they decided to keep and put aside. What they should have done was they should have maintained these things in the forefront so that people would have been able to see and understand what the heck was going on and how this Constitution was defined so that there would be no subjectivity that would be clear, concise as to what and how to do things, period. And so I think it's, imperative. It's imperative to understand that there has been zero, and you will not find evidence. I beg anybody to go and look at these ratification debates and prove to me that there is this defined term of a living document or this concept of the Supreme Court being able to make law and use interpretation as to how they think this thing was defined and the intent behind it. It's not there. It's very clear that the states were very jealous of this power being delegated to the general government, which is why they locked him into enumerated powers, which is why they did everything to, you know, alleviate this concept of general powers. This was a paradigm shift in the governing of mankind, that we only delegated specific powers to a, and we'll call it a national government, but I truly believe that the intent for the divine hand of providence, the intent was for this constitution to slowly go out throughout the world so that all mankind may be able to live under the protection of a constitution that guaranteed individual liberty and individual sovereignty. There you go. And so with that, we're going to kind of jump into the first set of notes. And the first set of notes is by Mr. Smith. And let's see, I don't know his first name. I've not spent too much time going through New York, just because Hamilton, I have such a bitter taste in my mouth over this man. If anybody wants to claim, and if you understand what the progressives recently did by putting on this play of Hamilton, they were aggrandizing this man because he was the one that created the theory of implied powers and interpretation. He was the one that injected the concept of precedence and case law and those types of things being, you know, slowly injected into our Constitution so that people wouldn't see the sleight of hand and understand that, hey, this is not constitutional. They have no business in doing this. Anyway, we will be back after these two promos. Thank you so much. Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our Republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on reclaimingtherepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so we're really at the point of the second person in the New York ratification debates, the second person to kind of take a stand. Because what ends up happening is that the debates are started by Mr. Livingston. Mr. Livingston kind of addresses and lays out the question of what they're there to do, and or lays out, you know, what they should be thinking about and what they're there to do and what should be the primary question of their debate. You know, do they move forward into a government that is, you know, defined, you know, and enumerated, or do they maintain their, you know, their membership in a defunct? Because by this point in time, you had already had 9 states. Okay, so they knew this. New Hampshire had just, you know, been the 9th state. Virginia being the 10th state that had not, because their ratification was just a few days away. And it took a good week plus to get that news up to the people in the New York debate. I believe it was a little over a week. But anyway, nevertheless, once they had that debate, you could actually see how things started shifting and Hamilton just stalled, because it only took a matter of time for people to start understanding that New York could be left out and surrounded by this new government body, the United States, and become an island like Rhode Island did. Anyway, so Mr. Smith starts off, and I want to, you know, point out a couple of things. And this is what he says. He most heartily concurred in the sentiment with the honorable gentleman who opened the debate yesterday. That was Mr. Livingston. That the discussion of the important question now before them ought to be entered on with a spirit of patriotism. There's that magical word, patriotism. Vigorously supporting one's country. Now, understanding that each state was a sovereign country at those days, and still is today, patriotism is the supporting of one's country. And as this new constitution shifted this, it no longer became, patriotism was no longer vigorously supporting the country, but it was to support the Constitution. With minds open to conviction, he says, with a determination to form opinions only on the merits of the question from those evidences which should appear in the course of investigation. Now, I would highly recommend that you get these debates, even the New York debates, and go through, because you'll actually see a lot of commentary regarding, a lot of commentary regarding slavery. If you understand, what was on the minds of these different states and so forth, as I pointed out, I think slavery was only mentioned a couple times in North Carolina. And it was basically saying, hey, you know, this is a good deal kind of thing. We should actually take this, because if not, you know, the sentiments in the North are growing anti-slavery, which in the New York ratification debates, you'll actually find that the comments of slavery. As a matter of fact, in Mr. Smith's comments, this is what he says in his second comment, because he had already talked about the slaves, the apportionment, and so forth. And then, actually, I need to probably let me see if I can get this right here. Yeah, no, this is right where we want to be. There was no kind of security except in the integrity of men who were entrusted, and if you have no other security, it is idle to contend about constitutions. In the third place, supposing Congress should declare that there should be one representative for every 30,000 of people, in his opinion, it would be incompetent to the great purposes of representation. It was, he said, the fundamental principle of a free government that the people should make the laws by which they are to be governed. He who is controlled by another is a slave, and that the government was directed by the will of anyone or a few or any number less than is will of the community is a government for slaves. And so he's kind of laying out this argument that, we're in this position of being turned into slaves. And he says, when we were colonies, our representation was better than any that was known then. Since the Revolution, we had advanced still nearer to perfection. He considered it as an object of all others the most important to have it fixed on the true principles, yet he was convinced that if the impracticable to have it yet that it was impractical to have such representation in a consolidated government. However, he said, we may approach a great way towards perfection by increasing representation and limiting the powers of Congress. He considered the great interests and liberties of the people could only be secured by the state governments. Okay? So, in other words, he just basically laid it out there. He considered that the great interests and liberties of the people could only be secured by the state governments. That's important because it adds to the sentiment that in this constitutional republic, the responsibility lied with the state governments, not with this national government that was being created. And now Mr. Hamilton stands up in response to Mr. Smith's and Mr. Livingston's comments. Actually, Mr. Lansing, because Mr. Lansing, you know, speaks out. And then Mr. Livingston kind of defends himself. And then Mr. Smith gets up and says, you know, I support, you know, what Mr. Lansing was saying and so forth. Anyway, Hamilton says this. What then shall we do? Shall we take the old confederation on the basis of this new system? Can this be the great object of the gentleman? Certainly not. Will any man who entertains a wish for the safety of this country trust the sword and purse with a single assembly on principles so defective, so rotten? Which is how it was with the Articles of Confederation. Plus, they were, you know, neutered. They were impotent in being able to fund themselves. Though we might give to such a government certain powers with safety, yet to give them the full and unlimited powers of taxation and the national forces would be to establish a despotism, the definition of which a government in which all power is concentrated into a single body. In other words, he's saying that they're kind of confusing their metaphors because, yeah, they can tax, but it's not like they've been given all powers concentrated into, into a single body. To take the old confederation and fashion it upon these principles would be establishing a power which would destroy the liberties of the people. These considerations show clearly that a government totally different must be instituted. They had weight in the convention who formed the new system. It was seen that the necessary powers were too great to be trusted in a single body. They therefore formed two branches, talk about the Senate and the House, and divided the powers that each might be a check on the other. This was a result of the wisdom, and I presume that every reasonable man will agree to it. The more this subject is expanded, the more clear and convincing it will appear to every member of this body. The fundamental principle of the old confederation is defective. We must totally eradicate and discard this principle before we can expect an efficient government. And so he then, you know, says a lot of other things, and then he kind of concludes his comment with this. The state governments possess inherent advantages, which will ever give them an influence and ascendancy over the national government, and will forever preclude the possibility of federal encroachments. And so it's not, if I alluded to the fact that there might have been some suggestions that there weren't these firm affirmations in the New York ratification debates regarding this, my biggest point is that in a document as robust and as verbose as the New York ratification debates, Hamilton wasted a lot of time getting into theory. And I think what he did was he put people into a trance or into a maze of confusing theories of politics so that, you know, when it came down to it, they just, their only argument was either be left out of the union or become a part of the union that every other state has automatically, there hasn't been one state that rejected this. Was New York going to be the first? Even Rhode Island didn't reject it. They just refused to ratify it. They refused to even address it until all of a sudden they started feeling the pressures and harassments from the remaining states. Because again, North Carolina was the only state other than Rhode Island that was out of the Union when the first session of Congress formed. And it wasn't until the last half of that session, North Carolina was able to send representatives in 1790, right? 1789 was the very first session. And so they ratified in, I think, November of 1789. And so they were able to send representatives in the beginning of the second half of the very first session. Rhode Island was nowhere to be found. And so they ended up, accepting this or ratifying the Constitution after the fact. But New York was literally facing this concept of, do we become an island or not? Anyway, I'll finish up this comment from Hamilton when we come back right after these two promos. So please stand by. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcasts and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so Hamilton at this point, and this is his final comment, by the way, before they adjourn, so you can kind of see how he ends up. You know, his final comment basically says, I'm a little exhausted. Let's continue this. And then there was a move for adjournment and they adjourned. Anyway, the state governments possess inherent advantages. I'm repeating this because this is important. The state governments possess inherent advantages which will ever give them an influence and ascendancy over the national government. Now, that concept is based on contract law because it is the state's compact. They have the inherent advantage because it is their compact. They can dissolve that general government just like that and will forever, and I try to keep my snaps away because anyway, for sound purposes, anyway, and will forever preclude the possibility of federal encroachments. That their liberties indeed can be subverted by the general head is repugnant to every rule of political calculation. Is not this arrangement then, sir, a most wise and prudent one? Is not the present representation fully adequate to our present exigencies and sufficient to answer the purposes of the Union? I am persuaded that an examination of the objects of federal government will afford a conclusive answer. Many other observations may be made on this subject, but I cannot now pursue them, for I feel myself not a little exhausted. I beg leave, therefore, to waive for the present the further discussion of the question. So, in other words, he's basically saying, hey, you know, let's, and that's what they do. They end up taking an adjournment for the day. And then, you know, Hamilton comes back a little bit later. And this is the other highlight in the following day for Hamilton. And it says, the balance between the national governments ought to be dwelt on with peculiar attention as it is of the must... punctuation problem. Instead of a comma, they had a period. But anyway, ought to be dwelt on with particular attention as it is of the utmost importance. It forms a double security to the people. If one encroaches on their rights, they will find a powerful protection in the other. Indeed, they will both be prevented from overpassing their unconstitutional limits by a certain rivalship which will ever subsist between them. I am persuaded that a firm union is as necessary to perpetuate our liberties as it is to make us respectable, and experience will probably prove that the national government will be as natural a guardian of our freedom as the state legislatures themselves. And so, you know, a little hyperbole probably, but the fact of the matter is I pointed out that the people at this point in time had, you know, high morals. They were all church going. Godless secularism was not embraced. It was not being forced down everybody's throat. And the concept of liberty and defending it was just the no-brainer. If they saw their liberties were going to be challenged and or possibly taken and or lost, it was very clear that the people would stand up, like he said, and literally become, you know, defenders of their liberty. The point is, though, that the reason we've gotten into this situation is because we have allowed the federal government to do things it had no business to do. And the reason we allowed it, we didn't knowingly allow it. They lied to us and they deceived us through cases of, you know, other decisions, case law, so forth, to, you know, bamboozle us into this acceptance. And it wasn't really acceptance. We were just deceived. To be clear, there were lots of people that were deceived, and there were lots of people that were influenced by lucre, by power, by whatever means possible to corrupting our government. The fact that we have survived this long in having some fundamental understandings of the Constitution just in itself is a miracle, considering the efforts of the enemy in trying to destroy us. Now, when I talk badly about Hamilton, it is not in context to Soros. In other words, Hamilton may have been an adulterer, but Hamilton was not promoting and paying to indoctrinate a homosexuality to our children and so forth. I mean, Soros is about, you know, as far as history goes, Soros and the rest of these elitists that are, you know, promoting all of this perverse concepts and perverse government, that is, you know, that's the highest notch of evil that humanity has ever seen. However, Hamilton himself created the door. He may have been a principled man, but he deliberately started undermining, and John Marshall as his, protege? Because Hamilton was the mentor, Marshall was the protege. You know, Marshall was the one that actually followed basically Hamilton's lead and his counseling and saying, okay, this is how we're going to do this. You're going to start making rulings. We're going to ignore the ratification debates completely. And we're going to start, you know, basically making some assertions in cases where you can actually make a legitimate ruling and your opinions will be used later in case law, because that's what they do. They say, well, Marshall said that the federal government had unlimited, you know, usage of the necessary and proper. If the federal government felt it was necessary and proper, they could do that. And that's how they were able to usurp these powers. Moving on, and a little bit later in that same day, Hamilton says this: "Sir, the most powerful obstacle to the members of Congress betraying the interest of their constituents is the state legislatures themselves, who will be standing bodies of observation, possessing the confidence of the people, jealous of federal encroachments, and armed with every power to check the first essays of treachery. They will institute regular modes of inquiry." So this right here did not happen. They never instituted regular modes of inquiry. You got to understand this. This was a huge failing that the states just blanketly trusted the federal government. And that's when there became this symbiosis of corruption, because people got involved at the state government to allow them to do things as they, you know, they got their power, they've got their riches, and so forth. And, you know, as I've said, many people, you know, believe that they were doing things that were considered honorable, but they were doing outright deceitful things, dubious things that were designed to actually take us down this path of our own demise. And he says, "The complicated domestic attachments which will subsist between the state legislatures and their electors will ever make them vigilant guardians of the people's rights." Now, the electors are those people who choose the president. "Possessed of the means and disposition of the resistance, the spirit of opposition will be easily communicated to the people, and under the conduct of an organized body of leaders will act with weight and system. Thus it appears that the very structure of the Confederacy affords the surest preventatives from error and the most powerful checks to misconduct." And so here's Hamilton once again pointing out that the states have, you know, everything in their control. They can do all of these things in stopping the federal government from encroaching upon their powers and encroaching upon their liberties. Unfortunately, that was about it. Unfortunately, there was really no follow-through. The states, I don't know why the states did not institute measures in monitoring and keeping the general government in check, other than the desires, as guys saw, you know, these, the first class and the second and third class, man, I want to be a part of that. And so they felt that if they started putting checks on those guys, that maybe they would be eliminated from being able to ever go up to that trough of power. So anyway, Mr. Clinton then responds to Mr. Hamilton, because Clinton had said something. His Excellency Governor Clinton spoke, Hamilton spoke, and now Clinton gets up and responds to how Hamilton addressed him. And he says, "The gentleman has attempted to give an unjust and unnatural coloring of my observations. I am really at a loss to determine whence he draws his inference. I declare that the dissolution of the Union is, of all events, the remotest from my wishes. That gentleman may wish for a consolidated, I wish for a federal republic. The object of both of us is a firm, energetic government, and we may both have the good of our country in view, though we disagree as to the means of procuring it. It is not fair reasoning to infer that a man wants no government at all because he attempts to qualify it so and make it safe and easy. Now, Hamilton gets up and responds to this, but I will get to that response after these two promos, so please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Folks, Red State Talk Radio has brought back its monthly newsletter. I know everyone gets a lot of emails, but this is not a daily or weekly newsletter. It's a monthly newsletter. So you will not be overwhelmed with a plethora of emails from Red State Talk Radio. Come on, it's only once a month. I'll be contributing a constitutional perspective to one of the current issues to help everyone see an alternative perspective, or what I believe would be a framer's perspective regarding the issue to help us maintain a constitutional paradigm. I will also provide information regarding a significant historical context to the time of year so that we can remember our history, so we will not be doomed to repeat the inevitable failings from forgetting our past and origins. Just go to Red State Talk Radio and sign up for the newsletter. This way you can get a focused view of what is going on in the Republic as well as what is going on at Red State Talk Radio. Thank you.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, this is the next. So Hamilton then gets up to reply to Mr. Governor Clinton. This is the one of four left citations that I wanted to pull out of this. I could spend a lot more time on the New York debates, but what I want to do is just kind of prove the consistency is here. You will find that there is really no assertions that support any other concept than a limited and defined enumerated constitution. The states are the arbiters, the final arbiters, and so forth. So anyway, this is what Hamilton says. I only rise to observe that the gentleman has misunderstood me. What I meant to express was this, that if we argued from possibilities only, if we reasoned from chances or an ungovernable propensity to evil, instead of taking into view the control which the nature of things or the form of the Constitution provided, the argument would lead us to withdraw all confidence from our fellow citizens and discard the chimerical idea of government. This is a true deduction from such reasoning. And then they go on. And actually, this is right before they adjourned again for the next day. And they come back on Monday. And on Monday, Mr. Chancellery Livingston, I believe, is the one that, yep, Chancellor Livingston, not Chancellery, Chancellor Livingston says this. What happens is Mr. Harrison speaks, then Livingston, then Lansing, Hamilton, and now Livingston. And this is what Livingston says. Congress have the power of making war and peace, of levying money and raising men. They may involve us in war at their pleasure. They may negotiate loans at any extent and make unlimited demands upon the states. Here, the gentleman comes forward and says that the states are to carry these powers into execution, and they have the power of noncompliance. But is not every state bound to comply? What power have they to control Congress in the exercise of those rights which they have pledged themselves to support? It is true they have broken in numerous instances the compact by which they were obligated, and they may do it again, but will the gentleman draw an argument of security from our facility of violating their faith? Suppose there should be a majority of creditor states under the present government, they may not combine and compel us to observe the covenant by which we have bound ourselves. The covenant being the compact, the Constitution. And so what is kind of interesting and what's really important to, you know, point out is that Chancellor Livingston was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, and he was not necessarily a rubber stamper of the Constitution. He was more of a, if you want to call him a servant of Clinton, he was there to kind of protect the state powers. And so he goes on, you know, and says a lot of different things. But bottom line is, what he's basically talking about is that, you know, what is the power? You know, can't they, you know, bound every state to comply? Can't they force every state? I don't think Livingston understood that Congress may have the power to call forth the militia, but the militia, because it is a state entity, because we are a self-governing people, that the militia was not going to just raise tyranny against their fellow family, against their kindred, their townsmen, their associates. That was not ever going to happen in the system that was designed. There was no way they could have actually gone down that path. Anyway, Mr. Livingston then comes back and says, "Sir, I venerate the spirit with which everything was done at the trying time in which the Confederation was formed. America had then a sufficiency, this virtue, to resolve to resist perhaps the first nation in the universe, even unto bloodshed. What was her aim? Equal liberty and safety, or so equality, liberty, and safety. What ideas had she of this equal liberty? Read them in her Articles of Confederation. True it is, sir, there are some powers wanted to make the glorious compact complete. But, sir, let us be cautious that we do not err, on the other hand, by giving power too profusely when perhaps it will be too late to recall it. Consider, sir," again, he's just completely forgetting that the militia is not a standing army. "Consider, sir, the great influence which this body armed at all points will have. What will be the effect of this? Probably a security of the recollection, or the re-election, as long as they please. Indeed, in my view, it will amount to nearly an appointment for life." Now, If you looked at Livingston and Mason, Livingston was basically Mason's counterpoint of being a convention delegate as well as being an anti-federalist. Anyway, he goes on and says, "What will be their situation in the federal town? Hallowed ground? Nothing so unclean as state laws to enter there? Surrounded as they will be by an impenetrable wall of adamant gold and wealth of the whole country flowing into it?" Here a member did not fully understand, called out to know what wall the government meant, on which he turned and replied, a wall of gold, of adamant, which will flow in from all parts of the continent." Now, I will say this, that because the federal government and the players over the course of our history were able to subvert and pervert this Constitution into doing things it had no power to do, this is exactly what did happen. At which flowing metaphor, a great laugh in the House. The gentleman continued, "Their attention to various business will probably require the constant attendance." He referred to, as a matter of fact, Livingston referred to Washington, D.C. as Eden. And he says, "In this Eden, will they reside with families distant from the observation of the people? In such a situation, men are apt to forget their dependence, lose their sympathy, and contract selfish habits. Factions are apt to be formed. If the body becomes permanent, the senators will associate only with men of their own class and thus become strangers to the condition of the people. They should not only return and be obliged to live with the people, but return to their former rank of citizenship, both to revive their sense of dependence and to gain a knowledge of their country. Some really interesting points he's making, but if you understand what Republic Review would do and some of these other things that we need to get injected, our first writer, that amendment and so forth, you'll see how all of these things we have the power and authority to actually fix. He goes on and says, this will afford opportunity to bring forward the genius and information of the states and will be stimulus to acquire political abilities. It will be the means of diffusing a more general knowledge of the measures and the spirit of the administration. These things will confirm the people's confidence in the government. When they see those who have been in high offices residing among them as private citizens, they will feel more forcibly that the government is their own choice. The members of this branch having the idea impressed on their minds that they are soon to return to the level whence the suffrages of the people raise them, this good effect will follow. They will consider the interests. So he's pointing out some really great points. And the last point that he makes is this. I think, sir, we must relinquish the idea of safety under this government if the time for services is not further limited and the power of recall given to the legislatures. And he's talking about the senators, that the senators need to be, you know, pulled back in. I am strengthened in my opinion by my observation made yesterday by an honorable member from New York to this effect. Quote, that there should be no fear of corruption of the members of the House of Representatives, especially as they are in 2 years to return to the body of the people. I therefore move that the committee adopt the following resolution as an amendment to this clause. Quote, resolve that no person shall be eligible as a senator for more than 6 years in any term of 12 years, and that it shall be in the power of the legislatures of the several states to recall their senators or either of them to elect others in their stead to serve for the remainder of the time for which such senators so recalled be appointed. He's really pointing out to the fact that when you send all of these people to the seat of government and that's where they reside, they stop representing you. And as a matter of fact, you know, he's spot on to, you know, this paradigm, and he's spot on what needs to be done. And I'm here to tell you, my friends, that with the passing of Madison's amendment in the Bill of Rights of limiting representation to 50,000 people and forcing that into effect would displace Congress. It would force them to be back home using telecommuting. The whole point was that because travel and communications were so arduous at the time, you had to go and live and reside, especially the further away you were from the seat of government. You had to travel and stay there because it took a month. It took a month to get from Virginia to Massachusetts. And so, what, you know, especially if you're traveling with household goods, you know, your family and so forth, you're in a carriage and the roads, you know, they were not weather-wise back then. Anyway, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we will summarize this in our next episode. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.